So my aim now is to cover another 11 surahs, from Surah 17 to Surah 27. The first verse in Surah 17 from Mecca reads, "Glory be to him who carried his servant by night from the sacred mosque to the farthest mosque, whose precincts we have blessed, that we might have him, some might show him some of our signs. Truly, he is the hearer, the seer." This particular verse is of quite significant importance, as I'll explain. The translation "furthest" in "furthest mosque" is Al-Aqsa. That's the Arabic. It's the name given to a small mosque built in the 7th century after the death of Muhammad at the extremity of the Temple Mount. If you've been to Jerusalem, you will have seen it. It was built on the site of an earlier Christian church. Muhammad, according to some, is recording there a vision he had of being taken up into heaven. A tradition grew up that on his way to heaven, he visited Jerusalem riding a winged horse through the sky. Hence the importance of Jerusalem for Islam, because of this event, dream, vision, it's pretty hard to see what we're dealing with, of Muhammad on the winged horse going to Jerusalem and from there ascending into heaven. Verse 25, "If you are righteous, then truly he is forgiving toward the penitent." I don't have to tell you that God's readiness to forgive is central to the teaching of Jesus, as it was central to his ministry. Jesus encouraged a paralyzed man, "Take heart, your sins are forgiven." And that particular scene, it's in all the synoptic gospels, that particular scene is there to remind us of faith. And the kind of paralysis that they're focusing on in this man is not a physical paralysis, it's the paralysis of sin. Jesus instructed his disciples, "Whenever you stand praying, forgive if you've anything against anyone, so that your Father in heaven may also forgive you your trespasses." Jesus shared his spirit with his disciples so that they too could be instruments of God's forgiveness. "Receive the Holy Spirit. For those whose sins you forgive, they are forgiven." And by the way, in John's Gospel, those present at the Last Supper are called disciples, not apostles. It's a more general term of disciples. This is spoken to disciples, all of us. "Whose sins you retain, they are retained." That's rather complex, but my best understanding of it is, if you hurt me and I don't forgive you, and you all know this, you're still in a sense bound. I'm binding. I'm holding, if I forgave you, well then we could reconcile and life could go on for both of us. But if I don't forgive you, you're always living with a hurt you've given that hasn't been forgiven. It's kind of retained. So the point, I think, of that Jesus' beautiful words at the resurrection in chapter 20 of John are, for heaven's sake, forgive. Because if you don't forgive, you're keeping people retained and bound, which is partly true. Paul picked up Jesus' teaching about God's forgiveness when he pleaded with the Christian community in Corinth to forgive a member who had behaved badly. He wants God's gracious forgiveness to flow through the community to this man. 2 Corinthians chapter 2. You should forgive and console him so that he may not be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow. I beg you to reaffirm your love for him. How beautiful is that? From Paul to the community. Wanting them to be instruments of God's constant offer of forgiveness. Christians don't limit God's forgiveness to the righteous. This is central to Paul's experience. As he wrote to the Christian community in Rome, and this is one of Paul's astonishing kind of conversion awarenesses, he says, God proves his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. God isn't responding nicely when we behave nicely. God is love. And so Paul came to see that he, in the midst of his behaviour, which you know about, persecuting the church for very good reasons and his own convictions, but then it grew on him that he was wrong and that he was blind, really, metaphorically if not physically. He just couldn't see. And then he was welcomed into the Christian community by that lovely old man Ananias and then the community itself and so on. And Paul never forgot that Christ's love came to him not when he repented, but when he was a sinner. And it was the love that enabled him to repent. Verse 26, Surah 17 still. Give to the kinsman his right and to the indigent and the traveller, but do not squander wastefully. James is faithful to his Jewish heritage and to Jesus when he includes in his definition of religion to care for orphans and widows in their distress. And James also insists on actions, not words. If a brother or sister is naked and lacks daily food, and one of you says, go in peace, keep warm, eat your fill, without supplying their bodily needs, what's the good of that, says James. And staying with James, he categorizes neglecting the poor as, quote, spending what you get on your pleasures as equivalent to adultery, for it's to break our part in our covenant with God. The wages, James writes, the wages of the labourer who mowed his fields, wages that you've kept back by fraud, cry out to God. James is the most Jewish. How beautiful is that? The most Jewish of the writers of the New Testament. James, the brother of the Lord. Some relation to Jesus. In his teaching on giving what we have to those in need, Jesus calls us to what this surah may consider, I don't know, to squander wastefully. There's a lack of measure in Jesus' teaching. In Medio Stat Virtus, in the middle stands virtue, is a Stoic, Greek Stoic statement. It's surely not right. Moderation in the middle, virtue standing. Sometimes wonder whether virtue is really when you have the extreme left and the extreme right, both there. energy rather than whatever. In any case, let's listen to Jesus and see what you might think. If anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go a second mile. This is wonderful stuff, because you're free. You're not a victim of that other person. If they do all this to you, that's what they're doing to you. But don't you change, don't you kind of organise things to get moderation going. No, go another mile. Keep your freedom. Give to everyone who begs from you, and don't refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbour and hate your enemy. That's an Old Testament view. They didn't know Jesus. We're not blaming them. And by the way, it's a very Islamic view, very Quran view. Love your neighbour and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. For your Father in heaven makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. Jesus, the image of God, absolutely transcends the image that the religious people of his own day had and learnt, and it absolutely transcends the image of God found in the Quran. Jesus' image of God differs from that revealed in the Surah. For Jesus, God's love is unconditional and extravagant. He calls his followers to emulate that love. Verse 31. Slay not your children for fear of poverty. We shall provide for them and for you. Surely their slaying is great sin. This statement, wonderful statement, granted the culture. This statement gives us an insight into the tribal customs of the time. The killing of children when you're too poor to bring them up. And to protect the lives of children born into poverty. Verse 32. Do not come near adultery. Truly, it is indecency and an evil way. Jesus, as you know, speaks against adultery. He goes further, challenging his followers to be pure in heart. One of the things I found, and I might have missed something, of course, but in reading the Quran, on the whole, morality is very much external. Not always, but just about always. It's what you do that's there. For example, in the prayer, you come together, all of the men are expected, of course, and you pray with the others. What a good thing to do. But that's what you're required to do. And if you do that, it's fine. There's very little in the Quran about what we're going to hear from Jesus. The morality of the heart. This is Jesus' statement. You've heard that it was said, and I don't mean by that Muslims don't live from the heart. That's not my point. I'm talking about the Quran's thrust. You have heard that it was said Jesus, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you, not doing the action isn't enough. Everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. still in Surah 17, verse 35, give full measure when you measure and weigh with a right balance. And similar injunctions, thank God, occur throughout the Quran. In the Christian scriptures, the principle underlying this exhortation is expressed by James, who's critical of injustice perpetrated by the rich. Quoting from chapter 5 of James' letter, your gold and silver have rusted. Their rust will be evidence against you, and it will eat your flesh like fire. You've laid up treasure for the last days. Listen, says James, the wages of the labourers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out, and the cries of the harvesters have reached the ears of the Lord of hosts. You've lived on the earth in luxury and pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in a day of slaughter. Verse 78. Perform the prayer at the declining of the sun until the darkening of the night, and the recitation at dawn. Truly, the recitation at dawn is ever witnessed. This call to prayer. It varies in different Muslim sects, but generally five times a day is expected. Some have three, etc. But this call to prayer, what a lovely thing that is, at dusk, at night, at dawn. It seems to me, for what it's worth, that one of the strengths of Islam is its simplicity. There are certain things not to do, and there are certain things to do, notably, as in this case, to pray at certain times. Ritual prayer is one of the five pillars of Islam. Jesus, as you know, encouraged his disciples to pray always and not to lose heart. Verse 81. Truth has come and falsehood has vanished. Truly, falsehood is ever vanishing. Tradition has it, according to the scholars I've been reading, that Muhammad recited these words when he witnessed the destruction of the idols around the Kaaba after the conquest of Mecca 2 years before his death in 630. The idols had been there all through his life. Finally, he's strong enough to actually not only defeat the Quraysh in battle. Now he comes to Mecca itself and was welcomed in to Mecca. And he destroyed all the idols because there's only one God, of course. And the suggestion is that that was the occasion for that particular Quran. Christians see Jesus as God's focal word, revealing who God really is. And throughout John's Gospel, it's this revelation that is meant by the word truth. Grace and truth came through Jesus the Messiah. The word truth in John's Gospel is not a correct conclusion to a syllogism. Nothing wrong with that, and that's a very good thing to do. But whenever you read truth in John's Gospel, it means it's an ultimate meaning. It means who God is. Really is. That's the truth. And that truth about God's graciousness is the essence of the good news. John 8, you will know the truth. The truth of who God really is. And it's hard to say that without remembering the fact that we kept, for good reasons, we kept the Old Testament scriptures as sacred. And they are. But they're so overwhelming in their stories, in the statements they make, and in the images of God, the imperfect images of God that they necessarily have, that when Christianity is put next, the New Testament is put side by side, and it's all called the Word of God, I don't have to remind you the danger of that is that the images, the imperfect images of God pre-Jesus, keep infecting the Christian message. So we end up with an obscured, well, it should be so clear, it's obscured by the stories we learned as children, Bible history, etc. It's not necessarily that way, but in fact that's what happens largely. You'll know the truth, says Jesus, about who God really is, and that will set you free. Paul says, free from the Torah, free from all those limited views of God that are there, because now we've got the truth. Jesus is called in John's Gospel the way, the truth, and the life. Jesus reveals God as love, that's the truth. He leads us to God, that's the way, so that we may share his love communion with God, that's life. Verse 86. If we willed, we is God of course, if we willed, we could take away that which we revealed unto thee. Keep going back to this, but the Quran keeps going back to it. This is another statement of God's freedom to reveal what God wants, irrespective of human logic or anything to do with us. God can do anything. God can contradict what God once said for good reasons, obviously, but God can do that. God isn't bound by what we might see as reasonable and logical. Progressing now to Surah 18, verse 47. Wealth and children are an ornament of the life of this world, but that which endures, righteous deeds, are better in reward with the Lord and better hope. As we saw when reflecting on an earlier surah, for Jesus too, there are values that transcend family. In regard to righteous deeds, Matthew quotes Jesus as saying, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. They will be filled. That word righteousness is a bit complex in English because it's lost a lot of its, as with most words, they all start from images and experience. Every word does. But the further you get away from the image and the experience, the more the word is abstracted and it can be easily used for a host of things. So righteousness is a bit of a tricky word in English, I think. But look at it, and I'll alert you to the etymology of it. It's made up from two words. One is right, obviously. Now the yesness is wise. So righteous means, it's a beautiful word, wise as to what is right. Well, who wouldn't want righteousness? Verse 106, that is their recompense, hell for having disbelieved and for mocking my signs, my revelation, and my messenger, Muhammad. In surah after surah, the Quran declares that God has chosen Muhammad to warn of the punishment of hell for those who do not accept God's revelation through him. That was my first surprise when I first read the Quran. Well, I'd read it before, but properly 3 years ago. And I was astonished that hell really appears on almost every page. It's a very, very dominant theme. Maybe at the time people had to be scared into something, but in any case, it is very dominant. Surah 19. This surah has nearly one third of all instances of calling God Ar-Rahman, the compassionate. It's also the only surah named after a woman, Mary, the mother of Jesus. Mary, as I've mentioned earlier, is the only woman named in the Quran, and this whole surah is named after her. The surah speaks first of Zechariah and the miraculous birth of his son John, taken from the New Testament stories. It goes on to speak of the virginal conception of Jesus by his mother Mary, called Miriam, obviously. And in verse 28, this is just a bit obscure really for me, and not only me, scholars as well, Mary in the verse 28 is called the sister of Aaron. Well, of course, that is the original Miriam. That's where the name comes from. But in the context, it's hard to know whether there's a confusion happening or just a reference out of kind of, well, whatever. In any case, Mary is called the sister of Aaron. Verse 35. It is not for God to take a child. Muhammad misunderstood the Christian belief that Jesus is the Son of God. I'm approaching it as I am. If I was a Muslim, I'd have to be saying that God was correcting false Christian teaching and telling us, no, God doesn't have a son. The section goes on to describe how Abram was banished by his father for failing to continue to worship the gods of his tradition by insisting on the truth that there's only one God. Brackets, there's no evidence in the Hebrew scriptures that Abram was a monotheist. In fact, monotheism emerged quite late, really. It seems to have kind of come into the consciousness of the people, because even the Ten Commandments, I am the Lord your God, you shall have no strange gods before me. There were gods all over the place. Their God was the real one, Yahweh, but they didn't deny the existence of other gods. But it was when they went to Babylon and saw the God of the greatest empire of the world being so pathetic that they thought, oh, wait a minute, what's going on here? And then begins the awareness that there aren't other gods. There is only one God. And thank God it's the God of Moses, the God of the burning bush, the God of our tradition. The surah speaks of Isaac, Jacob, Moses and Aaron. And then it talks of Ishmael, obviously, and then Idris, which is identified with Noah, another name for Noah. And the rest of the section is a condemnation of unbelievers. Surah 20. This surah tells the story of Moses at the burning bush. And it doesn't tell the story, it refers to the story, would be a more accurate way to put it. And his confrontation with the Pharaoh of Egypt. The escape of the Israelites, Moses' encounter with God on the mountain, and the people's infidelity in worshipping the golden calf, a favourite theme of the Quran. This infidelity goes back to the infidelity of Adam in the garden. This surah asserts that God is now revealing everything to Muhammad for the salvation of the human race. And that's why Muhammad and his followers must send this message out and convert everyone to Allah, to the God of Islam. Sura 21. There were Jewish and Christian tribes in Arabia during Muhammad's life. He, however, was born into a pagan tribe, the Quraysh, who were polytheists. Muhammad's key mystical experience was his seeing that there is only one God. It's this conviction that's expressed in every section of the Quran, including here in Surah 21. Verse 108 reads, "Say this, it is only revealed unto me that your God is one God. So will you be submitters." Muslim, belonging to Islam, submitters. Verse 91, "As for she who preserved her chastity, we breathed into her our spirit and made her and her son a sign for the world." A beautiful recognition of Mary and Jesus. Verse 92, "Truly this community of yours is one community, and I am your Lord, so worship me." But they have fragmented their affair among themselves. Each is returning unto us. And my comment, what it's worth, Muhammad witnessed the fragmentation of the Jewish and Christian communities that were divided into sects and denominations. The Quran rejoices that there were Jews and Christians who were joining the one community of Islam. Islam, however, as we know, and it would have broken Muhammad's heart, as the division in Christianity breaks the heart of Jesus, Islam also suffers from divisions. And Jesus' prayer, which we've all got to be part of, reads, "I ask not only on behalf of these," John chapter 17, Last Supper, "but also on behalf of those who will believe in me through their word, that they may all be one." And he's not primarily saying ecumenism, one. That's a beautiful fruit of this oneness. The oneness that John's talking about here, or Jesus in John, this is the oneness. "As you, Father, are in me and I'm in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me." The oneness that Jesus is praying is that each of his disciples and the whole community will be one in sharing his intimate communion with God. And of course, if we're one in that, we will be one in every way. But that's the key of it. Surah 22, and according to the scholars I'm reading, some of it comes from Mecca and some from Medina. Verse 17 reads, "As for those who believe, and those who are Jews, the Sabaeans, the Christians, the Magians," I'll come back to that in a moment, "and the idolaters, indeed, God will judge between them on the day of resurrection. Truly, God is witness over all things." In response a couple of days ago to an earlier observation, I think, I talked about the Byzantine Christians and the Iranian or Persian Christians fighting each other to a standstill. And that created a gap which enabled Islam very quickly to penetrate that area of the world. Well, I was mistaken in this sense, that the official religion of Persia was not Christianity, though there were dozens and dozens of Christian dioceses in Persia. It was Zoroastrianism, the Magians, the Magi. As regularly in the Quran, Christians are included among those who do not believe. The Christians who became Muslims, yes, very beautifully welcomed. The ones who didn't are disbelievers. Verse 19, garments of fire will be cut for them, and boiling liquid shall be poured over their heads, by which their innards and their skin will be melted. Verse 27, proclaim the Hajj. We haven't met that yet. Here it is. Proclaim the Hajj among mankind. They shall come to thee on foot and on all manners of lean beast, coming from all deep and distant mountain highways. As I did on the first opening presentation, this pilgrimage of the Hajj is one of the five pillars of Islam, one of the identifying marks. Monotheism, of course, ritual prayer, care for the destitute, and once in your lifetime, if possible, a journey to Mecca, to the Kaaba. Verse 78. Strive, and the Arabic behind this is jahada, jihad. Strive for God as God should be striven for. He has chosen for you and has placed no hardship for you in the religion, the creed of your father Abraham. He named you Muslims aforetime, and herein that the messenger may be a witness for you and that you may be witnesses for mankind. So perform the prayer, give alms, hold fast to God. He is your master and your excellent, and your how excellent a master, how excellent a helper. I did look at that earlier. Here's a beautiful example of the word jihad, meaning striving for perfection, striving for to live a beautiful life. And that is one of its usages. In presentation 5, we looked at the use of the word jihad in the Quran. It speaks of the commitment needed to live the way revealed by God. Unfortunately, living the way of God includes the use of violence to defend and to propagate Islam. Here, in this text, Muhammad is speaking of submission to God's will, striving to do what God commands and striving against what God has forbidden. For Muhammad, Abram was the first Muslim, the first to submit to the will of the one God. And all who share Abraham's faith are true Muslim. Moses was a Muslim. Jesus was Muslim. The prophets were Muslim, as Muhammad sees it. He didn't see himself as introducing a new religion, but going back to the very primary Abrahamic faith. Surah 23. This surah, or this section, gives a primitive account of how human beings are made. It tells the story of how Noah's revelation was rejected because he was only a mortal, and how Noah was saved until his opponent and his opponents were killed. This was the pattern for future generations. For Muhammad, Noah's being saved and the disbelievers being killed is an example of what was happening to him and to those who opposed him. Perfectly reasonable view of things from the human perspective. We're allowed to ask, is this direct revelation from God, or is God revealing God's self to Muhammad, who then, within the limits of his tribal world and all of that, gives expression to it in words? The words are his, I would say, not God's. And it's the same for Paul and Mark and Matthew and all the rest. The section goes on to speak of Moses and the son of Mary. It's full of advice as to what those who believe in God and God's revelation through Muhammad are to say when questioned. It comes from Mecca, the earlier period. Surah 24, from Medina. Most of this section consists in regulations for the purifying of home life. Muhammad is concerned to regulate every aspect of the lives of those who believe in God and who submit to the revelations given through him. From the beginning, Islam was a religious, yes, political, yes, social group. So they cover everything like that. As you find, of course, in the Hebrew scriptures. Cover every aspect of human life. In general, the Quran upholds traditional Arabic practices while legislating against blatant injustices. I'll read to you from verse 2 and 4. As for the adulterer and the adulteress, flog them, each one 100 lashes. Typical of the time. Those who accuse chaste woman but do not then bring four witnesses, how good is this? Flog them 80 lashes and never afterwards accept any testimony from them. A one in the light of the day, a wonderful protection against false accusations. They've got to bring four witnesses, and if they don't, they get punished. And here's something you might have been waiting for. It's the only text in the Quran about women's dress. And we need to look at it. Tell the believing women to lower their eyes and guard their private parts and not display their adornment except that which is visible thereof. I'm not quite sure what that means, but that's the direct translation. Let them draw their kerchiefs, rather funny translation, kimar. Other scholars suggest it's actually a cord that you can leave, because the women in the polytheistic world of Arabia weren't covering their breasts, as many cultures weren't. But this is a kind of a thing that you can draw and then hide your chin and your breast. So tell them to draw their kerchiefs over their breasts and not display their adornment, except, and they can display it at home, that's fine, with all these following people, except to their husbands, or their fathers, or their husbands' fathers, or their sons, or their husbands' sons, because there's a lot of wives around, or their brothers and their brothers' sons, or their sisters' sons, or their women, or those whom their right hands possess, the slaves in the house, or male attendants free of desire. Not quite where you find them, but anyhow, there they are. Male attendants free of desire, good luck, or children who are innocent of the private areas of women. Nor let them stamp their feet dancing, so that their adornments become known. That's the only text There is a little one later, which I've got there just to fill it out. In verse 30, Surah 33, a quick reference. Tell them to draw their cloaks over themselves. Well, that's all the Quran says, and it's clearly a little vague. And the rest of it is all from what we're talking about today. It's all cultural. Nothing particularly wrong with it. The burqa is a complete covering. I must say, it reminds me of the Sisters of St. Joseph that taught me as a boy. Like, complete covering, really. That's the burqa. Nothing wrong with it. It's a custom. This is where the problem lies for some of us, some cultures. And France and Denmark, I know, and probably others, have said this can't happen in their country. The niqab is the face cover. So sometimes you see the women wearing, in some cultures, the burqa, but also the niqab. Sometimes with a little tiny thing like that that they can see through, but you can't. Well, we're dealing with tribal, cultural matters here. And I think it's good. I think it's good that in when people come into, let's say, our country, and one of our attempts to help women be free from clearly a male imposition is to have the face showing. And there's the hijab, which is quite beautiful, is the headscarf, which you always see, frequently see women wearing. They're the three that I'm aware of. There are other names for those, but that's what we now are encountering. And seems to me, as long as women aren't dressed in a certain way because men tell them, and I suspect that's actually what's happening, but that can't be good. And I don't think it can be good if God is telling them how to dress. Doesn't seem to be at all interested in how men dress. That's a little odd, but there we are. Jesus' attitude and teaching regarding human misbehaviour comes from his intimate knowledge of God. It's not for us to condemn people in their sin. Rather, we're to offer them the love that can rescue them from sin. It's the only way you'll help me, because if you don't love me and you correct me, I think rightly I end up defending myself because you don't understand. I think we're all a bit like that. But if you love me and correct me, then I may well listen and learn and grow and reform. So love is the key, surely. John chapter 8 reads, early in the morning, Jesus came again to the temple. All the people came to him, and he sat down and began to teach them. The scribes and the Pharisees brought a woman who'd been caught in adultery. I don't have to add, because you're all adding it, what happened to the bloke? Leave that aside for a minute. And making her stand before all of them, they're all male, these blokes, they said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the very act of committing adultery. Now in the law of Moses, the Torah, it commanded us to stone such women." And it did. "What do you say?" So they've caught him, they think. If he says stone her, then he's fulfilling the law, but all this lovely talk he's going on with, no one will listen to him again. If he says don't stone her, then he's disobeying the Torah and shown to be a heretic. They said this to test him, to bring a charge against him. God, we've got a lot to learn from this. Jesus bent down and started to fill in a Sudoku. He started to fiddle on the ground. Don't make too much of that. He's just drawing in the sand, ignoring them in a way. But they kept on questioning. They weren't going to get away with this. He stood up, which they did for judgment. So this is his judgment on it all. He stood up and said to them, eyeballing them, of course, "Let anyone among you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." God help us. They had enough sense to know that he could see into their soul. So then he sat down again on the ground. When they heard it, they went away one by one, beginning with the elders. And Jesus is left alone with the woman standing before him. So he's down, looking up at her, not down at her. Jesus then straightens up and says to a woman, "Where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, sir." And Jesus said, so we're supposed to hear God here. Jesus said, "Neither do I condemn you." Go your way now, but don't sin again. That love that he gave her hopefully strengthened her. Verse 60. "As for elderly women," this is carrying on from what we just did, "as for elderly women who no longer anticipate marriage, there's no blame on them to doff their garments." Tiyab is the Arabic. I don't know what that is now because I don't know enough about women's dress in the 7th century. "Without displaying any ornament. And it's better for them to be modest, and God is hearing and knowing." Surah 25. This section lists the objections from his tribe, the Quraysh, against Muhammad's claim to be a messenger from God. It speaks too of the punishment of the flood at the time of Noah. We've heard that a dozen times, and here it is again. And the destruction of the towns of the Dead Sea at the time of Lot. Caravans from Mecca to Syria passed by the Dead Sea. It was there for all to see. This surah acts as a warning to those who refuse to heed the revelations made through Muhammad. They must listen to God, the creator of the universe. Verse 56, "We sent thee not only as a bearer of good news and a warner." Verse 57, "Say, I ask not of you any reward for this, save that whatsoever that whosoever decides may take away unto his Lord, and trust in the living one who dies not, and him his praise, and God suffices as one aware of the sins of his servant." Muhammad is being encouraged here not to seek any reward for what he's doing, except the reward of seeing people become faithful Muslim. He's to place his trust in God and not be discouraged by his own sins. God has chosen him, and that is enough. It's quite lovely. I'm reminded of Paul's words to the Philippians, "I regard everything as loss because of the surpassing value of knowing Christ Jesus, my Lord. For his sake, I've suffered the loss of all things, and I regard them as rubbish, in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him. I want to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and the sharing of his sufferings by becoming like him in his dying, if somehow I may attain the resurrection from the dead. Surah 26 tells the story of Moses and Pharaoh. It goes on to tell the story of Abraham and then Noah again, and the destruction of those who refused to believe. The Arabian tribe of Ad rejected the prophecy of Hud. I know nothing about this except what's here. The Arabian tribe of Thamud rejected the prophecy of Sali, another prophet of the time. The people of Midian rejected the prophecy of Sha'e. And the surah goes on to speak of God's revelation through Muhammad. And finally, Surah 27. Among other things, this section tells the story of Moses and the burning bush, again, or points to it, and his miraculous staff, and the story of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. It also tells the story of the destruction of the cities of the Dead Sea. Verse 62 reads, "He answers the one in distress when he calls upon him and removes the evil. Is there a God alongside God?" And I'm reminded of Jesus' prayer, "Do not bring us to the time of trial. Rescue us from the evil one." Reflecting especially on Jesus' agony in Gethsemane and his cry from the cross, the author of the letter of the Hebrews writes, "In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to the one who was able to save him out of death. And he was heard because of his reverent submission. God heard him. He was saved not from death, but out of death." And finally, verse 79. "Trust in God," says the Quran. "Truly thou standest upon the manifest truth. Surely thou dost not make the dead hear, nor dost thou make the deaf hear the call when they turn their backs. Nor canst thou guide the blind away from their error. Thou canst only make hear those who believe in our signs and our submitters." Muhammad is being told he's not responsible for those who don't believe. His task is simple: convey the revelation direct from God through the angel Gabriel to the people. So I'll conclude with a trusting Psalm.
His faithfulness and love, His love can never be measured.
Is fine.